It was too dangerous for him to stay there any longer than that with those German patrols combing the area. So the next night, a Belgium customs officer, Paul Tilcan, came on a tandem bike to take him to a safer location. So they headed out that night. My dad said it was pitch black, drizzling, pretty miserable. And they headed out. And because my dad had shrapnel wounds in that one leg, he could only pedal with his good leg. When they got to the bottom of the hill, they weren't able to pedal anymore, so they started pushing their bike up the hill. And they came to the top, and there was this cabaret, little cafe, and the lights were on, music was playing, people were talking loudly and laughing, and all of a sudden, two German officers come out with two young French girls, and one of them comes up to my dad, puts his arm around him, and asks him for a light for a cigarette. My dad's petrified. He can't speak German. At that time, he couldn't speak French yet. But Paul knew what they wanted and lit the guy's cigarette, and they let Paul and my dad continue.
Good evening and welcome to the Hero's Path podcast, where we explore untold stories of courage, leadership, and legacy, one conversation at a time. I'm your host, Colonel Retired Tom Rendall. My guest today is Steve Snyder, author, historian, and son of World War II bomber pilot Lieutenant Howard Snyder, who flew the B-17 named Susan Ruth during World War II. Steve's award-winning book, Shot Down, chronicles the incredible true story of his father and crew after being shot down over Belgium and the heroic efforts of the Belgian resistance that followed. Tonight, we'll hear what it was like to fly dangerous combat missions over Europe, relive the events of February 8, 1944, and explore the personal odyssey that brought this history to life. So, Steve, what inspired you to tell your father's story? Was this something that he talked about while you were growing up?
Well, he talked about it a little bit. Growing up, I knew the basics of my dad's World War II history. I knew he was a B-17 pilot. He was stationed in England with the 8th Air Force. His plane was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas. He flew bombing missions over occupied Europe and Germany. And on February 8, 1944, his plane was shot down. And he was missing in action for 7 months. But he evaded capture and eventually made it back to England. But it wasn't until I retired in 2009 that I really had the time to delve into my dad's war history in more detail. And my parents had kept a lot of material about the war years, and I just wanted to go through that and organize it and see if I could learn some more details. At that time, I had no intention of writing a book. And there was two items that were really significant. One was a diary that my dad wrote while he was missing in action about his plane being shot down. It's absolutely riveting. And the other were all the letters that my dad had written to my mother while he was stationed in England before being shot down. And going through those letters was unbelievable. He was very candid in the letters. He talked about what bombing missions were like, what life was like on the airbase, what life was like in England and London at the time, escapades of him and his crew. And I just became fascinated with the story of my dad and his crew, and it became my passion. So I started reading book after book about the air war over Europe, went on the internet, and spent countless hours doing research, downloading declassified military documents. I found relatives of all my dad's crew and asked them whatever information, pictures, articles that they could send to me. Started going to reunions, listening to veterans tell their stories. And finally, 3 years into my research, I just came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so unique that I decided to write a book. The first half of the book builds up to the day that the plane was shot down, and then the second half of the book is all about what happens on the ground afterwards. And it's just not about my dad, but it goes into detail about what happened to each member of my dad's crew and about all the courageous Belgian people that risked their lives trying to help them.
That's a wonderful intro. Thank you so much. So before we talk about the day that Susan Ruth was shot down, we should step back. What was it like flying combat missions in a B-17 in 1944? Let's walk through that fateful day, February 8, 1944. What happened on the mission? What led to the attack? And how did your father make it out alive?
Well, first of all, flying combat missions in the 8th Air Force was brutal and so dangerous. There were 26,000 men who were killed in the 8th Air Force, which is more than the entire Marine Corps fighting in the Pacific. And there were 28,000 other men who became prisoners of war after their planes were knocked out of the sky by German fighters or anti-aircraft fire. Being a combat crewman in the 8th Air Force was the most dangerous duty assignment in the United States military during World War II. And it was dangerous from the time they took off to the time they landed. In the 8th Air Force, there were 40 bomb groups located in England in an area called East Anglia, which is about the size of Vermont. And these bases were located only about 5 to 10 miles apart. So on the day of a mission, you could have hundreds of bombers taking off all at the same time. And these bombers had to form up. Individual planes formed up into three-plane elements. Elements formed up into bomb squadrons. Bomb squadrons formed up into bomb groups. Bomb groups formed up into combat wings, formed up into air divisions. And all this took an hour to two before they could even begin their mission. And back then, there was no radar air traffic control, and usually the weather was socked in, and so they couldn't see anything until they got above the cloud layer. So mid-air collisions were frequent, and airmen lost their lives. The next thing they had to deal with were the elements. These planes were pressurized back then. So above 10,000 feet, they had to go on oxygen, or after a couple of minutes, they'd pass out and could die. And also at the altitudes that they were flying, 20, 25,000 feet, it was extremely cold, minus 40 to 60 degrees below zero. And so frostbite was a huge problem. And one of my dad's waist gunners was in the hospital for 2.5 months from the series of his frostbite injuries. And then they had to deal with the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe. Germany had radar stations set up along the continental coast of Europe. So they knew when these bombers were coming, and they'd send up there the Luftwaffe, the Air Force, up to meet them. And at the beginning of the war, it was 8th Air Force Command's belief that these heavily armed bombers, the B-17s, had 1350 caliber machine guns because they could put out a tremendous amount of firepower. And so having all these heavily armed bombers flying in tight formations of hundreds of bombers, they thought they could ward off the Luftwaffe. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case in the early years of the war in 1942 and 1943. It was especially bad in 1943. In April of that year, they implemented a mission limit of 25. So if a crewman completed 25 missions, he could go back home. But it was statistically impossible to complete 25 missions in 1943. The average number of missions flown before being shot down was 6. And it culminated in the October of that year, what we referred to as Black Week, when over 4 missions, 148 bombers were shot down, almost 1,500 men. The worst day was October 14th, Black Thursday, on a bombing mission to Schweinfurt, Germany, to hit the ball bearing factories. 60 bombers were shot down. 10 of the 15 B-17s in my dad's 306 bomb group were shot down. Well, the 8th Air Force was in shock. There was no way that they could continue to sustain those losses, and they discontinued flying into Germany for the rest of the year. It wasn't until right at the end of the 44, the beginning of 45, with the introduction of the P-51 Mustangs, that these bombers had fighter support. They could escort them all the way to the target and back. And really, the P-51 Mustangs won the air war. By the time the D-Day rolled around on June 6th of 44, the Luftwaffe had just been decimated. But after facing enemy fighters, they had another problem. Once they neared target and they started their bomb run, then they had to deal with anti-aircraft fire, or FLAC. FLAC was the abbreviation for the German word for aircraft defense cannon. And they were powerful weapons. They fired 20 shells a minute, and the shells were calibrated to explode at the same altitude that those bombers were flying. And when the shells exploded, they were filled with all different shapes and sizes of razor-sharp metal that would burst out hundreds of feet and easily penetrate the thin aluminum skin of those bombers. Even though my dad said it was so cold at that altitude, he said going through those bomb runs, he would be sweating profusely, and his clothes would be sopping wet from perspiration and the adrenaline running through his body. And then after they got through with their bomb run, they had to face enemy fighters again on their way back to their bases. And even when they did near England, they faced a number of other dangers. The weather could be socked in, which was typical, so they couldn't even find their bases, or they could be running out of fuel. They could have injured or dead pilots on board. Their planes had suffered a lot of battle damage, engine shot out, controls, systems shot out, landing gear that wouldn't come down, which resulted in a lot of crash landings. And again, airmen would lose their lives. So it was flying combat was incredible. As far as my dad, when he was shot down, it was on a mission to February 8th, 1944, where they bombed Frankfurt, Germany. And during the bomb run, their bomb bay doors got hit by flak and they couldn't get them back up. And on their way back to England, they lost airspeed. They fell behind the formation and they were singled out by two German Focke-Wulf 190 fighters who, like wolves or lions, came in to swoop down on their prey. And in the ensuing air battle, the Susan Ruth was shot down. Two of the crew were killed in the plane during the attack. The other eight were able to bail out. But both those German Focke-Wulf fighters were shot down at the same time. One piloted by Siegfried Merrick crashed and he was killed in the plane. And the other one was piloted by Hans Berger, who was able to bail out and he made it through the war. During my research, one day my wife, Glenda, said, well, why don't you try to find the German pilot that shot down your dad's plane? And I'm thinking, oh gosh, she's so naive. She really doesn't know what she's talking about. It'd be impossible to do that. But like a good husband, I did what she told me to do. And I found Hans Berger. And fortunately for me, he became a translator after the war and he could speak perfect English. So he gave me some wonderful insight that's in the book about what it was like to go up against the Eighth Air Force.
Your father evaded capture for 7 months, hidden by members of the Belgian resistance and eventually joining the French underground. What stands out to you about that experience?
Well, that was a pretty amazing experience. After he bailed out, it's interesting. He was the first pilot and as such the commander of the plane and the crew, and he was the last one to bail out. And he and the plane came down in Belgium, but the other guys that were able to bail out actually came down in France and were either brought back over across the border into Belgium by German troops that captured him, or by members of the French underground that brought him back into Belgium for medical treatment. After my dad bailed out, he came down in these trees right at the French-Belgium border, and his parachute got hung up in the branches, and it was dangling 20 feet off the ground and could not get down. But fortunately for him, a couple young Belgian men, Henri Franken and Raymond Dervin, came to his rescue before the Germans got to him. He came down early afternoon. They went back to the farmhouse, got a ladder and a rope, helped him down a tree, and they told him to stay put and hide, and they'd come back to get him that night because they thought it was too dangerous for them to try to move him daylight because there were German patrols combing the area looking for these guys. So that night, they came back, got him, took him to the Dervin farmhouse. My dad had some shrapnel wounds in his legs, and Raymond Dervin's mother helped clean him up a little bit, but he only stayed there one night because they thought, again, it was too dangerous for him to stay there any longer than that with those German patrols combing the area. So the next night, a Belgium customs officer, Paul Tilcan, came on a tandem bike to take him to a safer location. So they headed out that night. My dad said it was pitch black, drizzling, pretty miserable. And they headed out. And because my dad had shrapnel wounds in that one leg, he could only pedal with his good leg. When they got to the bottom of the hill, they weren't able to pedal anymore, so they started pushing their bike up the hill. And they came to the top, and there was this cabaret, little cafe, and the lights were on, music was playing. People were talking loudly and laughing, and all of a sudden, two German officers come out with two young French girls. And one of them comes up to my dad, puts his arm around him, and asks him for a light for a cigarette. My dad's petrified. He can't speak German. At that time, he couldn't speak French yet. But Paul knew what they wanted and lit the guy's cigarette. And they let Paul and my dad continue. My dad said they were too, as he put it, schnocker, or too drunk and too interested in these young girls to pay much attention to a couple of yokels pushing a bike up a hill in the middle of the night. And after that, my dad was moved from place to place. How long he stayed at any given location depended on how brave the people were who lived there and how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there. He might spend one night, he might spend 6 weeks. And the people who helped my dad, for that many, any down there men, were unbelievably brave people. They risked not only their lives, but the lives of their family and friends. Because if the German secret police, the Gestapo, found out about it, it would be arrested, tortured, then to a concentration camp or shot. And some of the people who helped my dad and other members of his crew did meet that fate. And it was very stressful for my dad in hiding. He almost got discovered several times. And there's instances described in the book where he was almost discovered. So it was very stressful for him. And then usually when the underground came across downed airmen, they tried to get him back to England through various escape routes, down through France, over the Pyrenees, into Spain, and then out through British-controlled Gibraltar. But something always went wrong trying to get my dad out. Oftentimes, these networks were compromised. German infiltrators or members of them arrested or killed. And that was very frustrating for him as well. And then word came on June 6th of 44 that the Allies had landed at Normandy. And my dad knew that the U.S. Army was coming up through France. And so he decided to join the French resistance to fight against the Germans. His helpers tried to talk him out of it because it was much too dangerous. He could be killed fighting against the Germans, and if the Germans captured him, he'd be shot on the spot as a terrorist. But he felt it was his duty to get back in the war, and one of his helpers, Amy Kubels, they rode bicycles back down over the Belgian border into France and hooked up with a unit of the French resistance. They were also called the Mackie. They were made up of small ragtag guerrilla groups located all across France. And they basically harassed the Germans. They would attack convoys, disrupt communications, attack or blow up railroad lines, assassinate German officers. And they got their instructions from the British through coded messages over the BBC. And my dad said the information that they gave to him was unbelievably accurate. They said if a German patrol was coming down this road on this day at this time, sure enough, they'd be there. And that was a result of the British cracking the German Enigma code and knowing everything that the Germans were up to. And they were also supplied by the British through airdrops. So my dad fought with them for a couple months. And then finally, 7 months after bailing out on September 2nd of 44, word came that there were U.S. troops in the nearby village of Treslong, France. My dad walked into town, went up to an army major, actually it was an element of Patton's Third Army, which had come up through France after D-Day, and identified himself. They interrogated him to make sure he was who he was supposed to be. Then he caught a convoy taking German prisoners to Paris, and then from there hopped on a transport and got back to his base in England, where he sent a Western Union telegram to my mother saying he was fit as a fiddle, back at base, and banked the money, honey, because they had all that back pay coming.
That was wonderful. One of the more surprising chapters is in your relationship with Hans Berger, the German pilot who shot down the Susan Ruth. How did that friendship develop?
Well, after my wife said, why don't you try to find him? I Googled trying to find a Luftwaffe pilot, and a couple of forums came up, which I joined, and I posted inquiries on those forums because I knew the day he was shot down, the location of where he was shot down, the time that he was shot down. And in a week, two guys got back to me, one from England and one from Belgium. And on that day, there were 12 B-17s shot down, and the one shot down just south of Chimay, Belgium, just north of the French border, was shot down by Hans Berger. And the guy in Belgium that contacted me happened to be a Luftwaffe historian and had written a number of books about the Luftwaffe and was friends with Hans Berger. And he was the one that told me that he could speak English, and I wanted to contact him. And because all my dad knew and all the Air Force knew was that my dad's plane was shot down by two German Focke-Wulf fighters, and that's all I thought I'd ever know. So he contacted Hans and asked him if he'd be okay if I called him or got in touch with him. He said, yeah. And then for the book, I just interviewed him through email and through telephone calls. And I can't tell you how excited I was to find Hans Berger. I was just beside myself, and I was just bombarded him with questions. And at one point, he goes, Steve, I really don't know you that well, and you're asking me all these personal questions. But I built up his trust, and we developed a friendship. And then in 2016 and 2018, I made trips to Munich, Germany, to visit him and got to know him. I did an interview with him. Actually, it's included in a little documentary, 13-minute documentary than I did. And he thought it was pretty remarkable, too, that here he is talking to the son of a pilot that he shot down and the crew. I found out from Hans that the gunners on my dad's plane shot him at the same time he shot my dad's plane down. They shot each other down. So there was a real kinship there. And he said it was too bad that they had to be shooting at each other, but that was war. They were fighting for the country, trying to do a job and trying to stay alive. So we developed a great friendship. This last year, in 2024, I went over for the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Belgium, my eighth trip to Belgium. And I'd hoped to visit Hans one last time, but he died in January of 2024 at age 100. So I was not able to meet him. But that, I have to say, that was one of the highlights of my life, meeting Hans Berger and becoming friends with him.
What do you think your father would have had to say about that relationship?
Oh, gosh, I think my dad would have loved to have met Hans, and I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall just sitting there and listening to their conversation and what they said for each other. The airmen in the 8th Air Force and the airmen in the Luftwaffe, they had a unique kind of relationship, unlike the ground troops and fighting in Japan or against the Japanese or in Germany. They had a real respect and honor for each other. And so there, I don't think they would have, because that's another thing. When you're up in the air, you really don't see your enemy face to face. So it's not quite as personal. I think that's what a lot of those guys planned those combat missions. They really didn't consider it, even though there was collateral damage and killing people. They were more because the 8th Air Force tried to hit military and industrial targets to cripple Nazi Germany's ability to wage war, unlike the British that had area bombing and they targeted cities to try to demoralize the German population. So I think the airmen in the 8th Air Force considered it wasn't as personal. They were trying to destroy targets rather than people, even though they knew that they were killing people.
Yeah, that's right. The war did start out with a degree of chivalry, and the crews always thought about trying to drop the bombs on military targets. But then later in the war, things changed. And of course, that's how the victory was won. But the interesting part is we learned in the Masters of the Air series that, as you said, when the Mustang could reach Berlin, or Russia in that case, and it was this futuristic fighter that the Germans couldn't match, and even the Thunderbolt developed extended range as well, and they would range around and knock the German fighters out of the sky when Doolittle said, I want you to kill the fighters. And that changed everything from just escorting bombers. But that obviously came after your father had been shot down. And it really did ruin the Luftwaffe. And General Marshall had agreed with General Eisenhower that they would not request to land in France until they had done exactly that. They had to drive the Luftwaffe back across the Rhine. And once that was achieved, the invasion could go forward.
Absolutely. Yeah. Without the 8th Air Force, D-Day never would have happened because they had to wipe out the Air Force to protect those troops landing on the beaches of Normandy.
So as you've gone through this journey, what is it that you've learned about your father that surprised you the most?
Oh, gosh. I had two sisters, Susan Ruth, who this plane was named after, and Nancy, who was actually born while my dad was missing in action. So that was really tough on my mom, having a one-year-old Susan and then an infant Nancy, never knowing if she'd see her husband again. But my sisters and I always compared my dad to John Wayne, or for those who might remember Gunsmoke, James Arness. My dad was a tall guy, big guy. He played basketball on the basket. Even though he was only 6'3", back then he was the center on the basketball team. And he was a no-nonsense type of guy. He had strong morals. He was a devout Christian. Things were black and white. He believed in discipline. But he was a wonderful dad. Yeah, we were very close. He coached me in Little League and went fishing and all that. But I think I'd never really appreciated how brave and how courageous he was. I mentioned after the Allies landed at D-Day, he decided to get back into the fight. And I can't believe how much courage that took. The smartest and safest thing for him to have done was just to stay hunkered down and in hiding and wait for the U.S. troops to come up through France and then liberate the area. But he felt there were Americans fighting and dying for their country, and it was his duty to get back into the fight. And I don't know how many people in his situations would have decided to do that. I doubt if I would. So just to show his character in doing that, I think it's pretty amazing. Also, I just gained an appreciation for the courage and sacrifice of all those guys, not only 8th Air Force, but in World War II, gave to fighting for their country. Back then, the U.S. was a totally different country. I think about 45% of the population lived in rural areas. It was very provincial. Most guys never been out of their home counties before. Were not exposed really to the world at all. There was no social media, no TV or anything. And they pretty much stayed with their people like themselves, either based on race, religion, nationality. And all of a sudden, World War II comes. And here are these guys that are late teens, early 20s. My dad was an old man. He was 28. But all of a sudden, they're halfway across the world fighting in a war, late teens, early 20s. They're fighting this war with people they had never associated with. Different, like I mentioned, different religions, different, Irish, Italians. And they answered the call. They answered their country's call. to preserve freedom into the first few years of the war until maybe 43, that the Axis powers, Japan and Germany, they were winning the war. A lot of people don't realize that. They think, well, the U.S. just came in and they won the war. No, the war was really in doubt for the first few years, but the entire country rallied and answered the call. They were the greatest generation.
They certainly were. So what lessons from the story resonate most with younger generations today?
That's a good question. It's 80 years ago that the war ended, and World War II is fading in people's memories. And that's why I do what I do, to try to avoid that from happening. Because the U.S., we've had it so good since World War II, people don't realize what it cost to gain the freedoms that we enjoy today. It's so easy to take them for granted. But we wouldn't have those freedoms unless people fought for them. I'm just starting to watch the PBS series, American Revolution. So another one of those Ken Burns, becoming epic things. And it reminded me back then, it was similar to World War II. They had all these dispersed colonies, just that people weren't really close. But they all banded together when they needed to fight for the freedoms that they thought they deserved and to protect freedom like they did in World War II. There was no other event in history that affected more people than World War II. 60 million people died. Millions more were wounded. Millions more were left homeless and displaced. It changed the course of America and the world forever. The brave young men who fought and died for freedom, their sacrifice just must never be forgotten, and it's our duty to remember.
You said that so beautifully, and I agree. That's the lesson from your story. That's the lesson from all that we've done so far on this World War II journey, beginning with that Masters of the Air series. So thank you so much for the way you said that. And it comes across in such a way that I can't believe that a young person wouldn't be interested. And I hope that you do find yourself in front of younger audiences from time to time.
Well, I go to a lot of air shows signing copies of my book, and my two favorite audiences are anyone who buys my book. Anytime a World War II veteran buys my book, that's a total honor. And even more of an honor is when they tell me that they enjoyed it. But the other is when young boys and girls as young as 5 and 6 are interested in learning about history, learning about World War II, and buy my book. That discourages me more to spread the word and try to tell the story.
For listeners who want to research their own family's World War II stories, what practical advice would you give?
Oh, gosh. Well, I was so blessed and so fortunate to know so much about my dad and his crew. I have to say, I couldn't have written a book for two Belgian gentlemen, Dr. Paul Delahaye and Jacques Lalot. They were young boys during the war. They were greatly affected by it. They saw firsthand atrocities committed against their family and friends by the Nazis. And they later in life, they became local historians and interviewed all these people that were involved in the Belgium underground and involved in events with my dad and his crew. They documented their testimony and gave me unbelievably detailed information that had been lost forever. So I owe them a huge debt. But I think there's a number of resources actually on my website, stevesnyderauthor.com. My website is not just about my book, but there's so much more. I have a tab, Education and Research, that has all sorts of information about World War II, not just about the air war over Europe, but there's one section about veteran research that you can go to that has websites and links to websites that you can look up your veteran's story. Most of my research was, since my dad was in the 8th Air Force, he was 8th Air Force oriented. And I know if anyone has somebody in the 8th Air Force on websites and Facebook pages, every bomb group has a page. You can join that and post inquiries to that. But I would try to Google, if you know who your loved one, your vets, whether it's an uncle or a grandfather, what have you, and see if you know what unit they're in, find if there's unit websites, your vet, and find out about them. But it just takes a lot of digging. Like I said earlier, I spent hours doing this for months and hit a little nugget, and then you go down a rabbit hole. And if you keep at it, you can eventually find and you'll come across nuggets and then hopefully find out a lot about your veteran. As I mentioned, I go to a lot of air shows around the country, and it's just a shame that the majority of the people I talk to know so little about their veteran because their veteran didn't talk about it. And most guys didn't. I was fortunate that my dad did, because those guys are amazing. They don't look at themselves as heroes. They came back after the war. They just wanted to get on with their life, get married, get a job, and continue And so, unfortunately, most relatives of veterans don't know that much about it. But and that's just a shame. Like I said, I'm just so fortunate. But you just have to dig and keep at it and go to any resource you can. But I encourage people to go on my website because there's a lot of help on there.
Well, that's great. Now, any final remarks you'd like to make outside what we've talked about?
I mentioned that when I started this, I had no intention of writing a book. But it's changed my life completely. It's given me a second career, total passion for what I do to kind of keep the memory alive of particularly the 8th Air Force, the 306 Bomb Group, of which I'm president of. And it's just so rewarding because I meet so many people all across the United States talking to them who have interest or trying to create interest or learn about their veteran. And anytime someone contacts me on email or social media, if there's any way I can help them in their search for their veteran, try to do that. So it's changed my life. I've been doing this now for 11 years since I wrote the book. I don't know how much longer I'll be doing this, but we'll say I had a little excitement here that this year is that I signed an option and purchase agreement to make it into a movie. So that should start the process, but it takes quite a long time to make a movie. But hopefully that'll come to fruition someday. And that would be my ultimate dream. I love my dad, and now I have a little grandson, a 3-year-old grandson, named after my dad, Howard Snyder. So we have a new little Howard Snyder to keep his legacy alive.
Well, that is just so beautiful. And I can't thank you enough for this. And you've told us how people can get in touch and stay in touch and watch the development of this book as you take on a project, hopefully watching it become a screenplay. It certainly would be a wonderful story. And we're seeing a lot more World War II stuff on the television, in downloads and everything else. So it's a very excellent possibility. Well, Steve, once again, we can't thank you enough for joining us tonight. You've really brought something special because you've done this wonderful presentation, the book, and all the great things that you've done. Audience, I'd like you to know that Steve's book, Shot Down, is available wherever books are sold. It's certainly up on Amazon. It's doing very well. I have a copy. It's wonderful. And I'm enjoying reading it late at night because that's the only time I have for reading. I will probably get the audio book as well because I like to move back and forth from the Kindle to the Audible book just to enjoy someone reading while I read through the pages. Thanks for sharing your father's legacy. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us on the Hero's Path podcast. I'm retired Army Colonel Tom Rendell. Until next time, stay curious, stay grateful, and keep the stories alive. Rendell out.
Steve, thanks so much. What an incredible story.
And thank you for what you guys do.
You bet. Take care, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
God bless.